Welcome to The Crucible, where the Southern African Institute of Mining and Metallurgy gives you a front row seat to conversations with specialists in the minerals and metals sector. SIAM has well over 100 years' experience in and commitment to protecting the professional standards of our industry. Join us now as we discuss the key issues and global initiatives to give you the relevant information needed to make informed decisions, to influence policy that directly affects our sector, and to help our industry grow in an uncertain future.
Welcome to part two of The Crucible, as we have our discussion with Arjun looking at the key success factors of operational excellence initiatives in the mining industry. Often you'll find that the organizational culture will be built up based on people's mindset to collaborate collectively.
Yes.
And one of the things that also happens within the industry itself is that it's very slow at adapting and changing, be it new technology, be it new ways of doing things. I think it is very quite evident that the mining industry is slow in changing. And some of the symptoms I think that we are also seeing in the industry is that we are not able to retain female engineers in the mining and minerals industry because of how it's structured and all. But from your experience, how effective has it been to actually bring about transformation within an organization that's operating within the mining and minerals industry?
So the clients we're working with want to change, but let's just take the technology aspect. So all the mines that we have spoken to, and we could talk about the global miners too, they all have massive technology departments, R&D departments on how to make things effective. And that where it basically falls flat is that when you come to the actual operations of implementing it, is that it seems like it's addressing one thing, but the practicality of really making it happen effectively becomes a problem. So what you usually find is the majority of staff are suspicious of what is this technology. And there's a real fear, obviously, of people losing their jobs. So that's kind of like, you know, how do you navigate around that? But I haven't found, what we find is that there's a lot of technology and there's a lot of technology thinking and there's a lot of technology that the mining wants to bring in. But we find that right at the bottom end, where the rubber hits the road, is not translating into the benefits they want to see. And so you find there's kind of like, some mines will do it more effectively. Others will pull back a bit. Some will say they were burned. Others will say we're not ready. And then others, like a greenfield, like let's say Venetia mine. I mean, they got all the latest technology put in there. It became easier for them because they took quite a long journey. They took their people with them in that journey. The mindset change there was pretty big. This is where you're at. This is where we're going to move to. They were communicative. They did everything. And they involved us, obviously, in the supervisory side, which shows that they were thinking about technology, thinking about people, thinking about leadership, which is quite good. So how effective is it with us transforming companies? Very effective. If the companies basically understand exactly where they want to go to, what challenges they have, and where they need help. And that's where it works. So as I said, if you have a toxic culture, if you don't address the toxic culture first, so if you basically think the mine is going to turn around or we're going to change this mine because we're implementing a Lean Six Sigma program, if the culture is toxic, what you find is within 6 months to a year, no benefits will stay, because everything we do in the world is relationship to people. But if we find that the companies that obviously we take South Deep as kind of like the biggest example that I can think of right now, is they had a Section 189. Look, so they didn't make money for about 11 years. They had a Section 189, that kind of like a violent strike, and then they said we're going to do the transformation, of which OOM was asked to do. So the first thing you want to do is you want to bring in healing. Because people have been hurt, but the environment and everything and the strike. And remember, after Section 189, there's what some people call survivor syndrome, which is, why wasn't I retrenched? what happened. And so people get this feeling of guilt, and not, well, not everyone, but there's a kind of like a bit like that. And so then what we did is we said, we need to bring healing. We need to get everyone on board. Same focus, management, leadership, and the workforce. And that's where we did the culture initiative. And we said, guys, this is just who South Deep will be going forward. And these are the ways that we will, from a human point of view, interact with each other. So not the technology, not the process stuff. This is how we are going to work towards the goal. But as individuals, as humans together, the whole moving together, focusing, willing people. That's focused people, willing people. Once we got that right, once the culture shifted, once people, the penny dropped, once people said, ooh, geez, no, bing, penny has dropped now. Then it was pretty, I was going to say pretty easy, but I mean, then it was easier to do a full-blown transformational change with technology, processes, and the whole people side too. Because once that was established, once trust was established amongst all the stakeholders, transformations was easier to roll out. It was easier to do processes because people knew, hang on, they're not doing this thing to hammer me in the background. It's actually a benefit for me. We're doing all of these things. You're capacitating supervisors, you're capacitating your section managers, your production managers, et cetera, et cetera. Once everyone saw that, you're putting in an MOS for visibility, which is visibility for everyone, the whole workforce. You're doing all of these things. You're creating a war room. And so that makes it very successful. But the success in the beginning is the right mindset. If you're trying to change a company, but you cannot change a toxic mindset, and you cannot change a toxic mindset with factual arguments. Mindsets are built on emotion. And there needs to be an understanding of, we are all emotional beings here. It doesn't help you stand in front of me and factually tell me something. I'm still angry at you. You might be factually right, but I'm angry. We need to work through that stuff. And so we always say, you got to get the emotional side fixed first, before you start hammering on the factual side. And we sometimes find clients are like, we were going to hammer you on factual, but emotionally we don't really care about you, you know? So we go, oh, no, that doesn't always work that way. Because emotions clouds how we do business with each other. This is starting to sound very wishy-washy, funny, fuzzy, daddy stuff here, Kunwane. Touchy-feely kind of like stuff here. And this is, mining stuff, you know? Why is this all touchy-feely?
No, but I actually do resonate with that. And if we think about things that also are touchy, mm-hmm. You will realize that when it comes to safety, it's really a big deal within the mining industry. And I think the worst thing that can happen to a team, for example, mm-hmm. is them losing a team member underground.
Yeah.
And I mean, when they introduced Section 54, it means, again, they'll lose on productivity because they've lost lives. So yeah. Productivity then obviously will also get impacted by yeah. how we handle safety. And part of safety is a certain mindset that we need to carry. And you are actually right. There'll be times where you are upset with an individual, so upset that it can get violent. And that can have also direct impact in terms yeah. of how people carry on in terms of executing their work as safely yeah. as possible, but also being present and aware
yeah.
of their surrounding. So I was just wondering, in terms of the safety aspects, to what extent do skills and competencies also play a role in that regard? And in part of improving productivity, you'll find that most teams want to do as much as they can, as quickly as they can, while taking shortcuts, which can also be a problem. So how do we then find that right balance between ensuring we have a safe production, but also we're doing our level best in terms of being productive in an environment?
So our whole focus is the frontline leader, your supervisor. We basically believe that your supervisor is the safety leader and the production achiever. So that's the one thing there. there must be a framework, and there must be a from the top. Leadership from the top must be talking about safety, and they must be looking at safety to ensure that safety works. When we work and coach with the supervisor, what we try and bring across to him is that he mustn't the one minute think he's looking at production and the next minute think now it's safety. It is one. When he stands there, he is the embodiment of safety and production as one thing. He shouldn't be breaking his mind into silos. And I sometimes feel that when you're working in companies, you have the safety guy give his thing and you got the production guy giving. And sometimes you get worried that they might be giving contradictory messages. And sometimes you find your teams play on that. You know, they say, well, you want productivity, but you know, what about safety? And we say, no, it's all built in. It's one. It's one thing there. We know from stats, South African stats, I think for every 300 LTIs, you'll have a fatality. We get that from, the DRM. E stats yearly. The funny thing there is on the safety capability and competence, we're not noticing problems. Leadership and teams all understand how to operate safely. That we're not finding there's a non-understanding of what needs to happen on the shift. Depending on how the safety talk goes and the tool, that we're finding that's not the problem. We did some work with the University of North West, the AFRWT. I have no idea how to say that name. You're going to have to work that out of the podcast. But anyway, the University of North West. And they did a study and they said 80% of safety incidents is mindset. They say 3% of acts of God and the rest is basically processes not followed. Or not effectively put in place. So our whole challenge is we want to change the mindset of the individuals around about safety. And if you look at the safety issues that really pop out, like psychological safety, we ask, one of the things you always ask your team is, okay, on the psychological safety side, at the team meeting, you want your people to speak up and say, look, it's not a safe environment. We worried and we need to analyze safety and we need to work around that. But what you find is that depending on the individual doing this, the meeting, the daily meeting, is if the majority of the team do not feel psychologically safe, as in able to speak their mind and know that there won't be consequences, they potentially might not say anything and walk into an unsafe environment because they kept their mouth shut because they were scared of the consequences of speaking up. So that's one of the things we teach the safety and the frontline leaders about safety is you need your team to speak up and they must speak up without worrying that there'll be some consequences to them being able to say, look, I'm not comfortable. Now you'll find that's the message that top leadership always say, speak up, there's slams, everything, do that. But the reality is that, we might be scared if we speak up, the supervisor, the MO, the superintendent might come along and say, you just don't want to work hard or whatever there is. The other thing, we look at stress factors. Some of the stress factors are literally, we don't plan properly. So if you don't plan properly and things happen, you get stressed. And so we say planning actually solves a lot of the stresses around safety because planned work is safe work. So you start doing those concepts there. So we're not finding that people aren't able to do that. We're just finding is that the mindset needs to be adjusted. I was speaking to a company in Papua New Guinea and they said it's very difficult to talk about a safety mindset on the mine when in their villages, people are basically being attacked and murdered on a weekly basis. And so death is normal. And then they come to the mine and you get to, you've got to honor people and make sure that there's no, and now you're trying to tell people that have, I don't want to say normalized death because that sounds terrible, but in essence, it's become kind of like normal that suddenly on the mine, they supposedly have to be these perfect, wonderful, safe people. So how do you change the mindset? Because that's not, if you go to any South African mine, the safety processes put in place I wouldn't say world class. They are world class. If you look at how the deaths have come down, and I'm obviously not trying to negate the Cage Four and beginning of the year Goldfields had that, I think a few fatalities, or I think one or two. If you take that, and you'll notice that there is a concerted effort in South Africa to make sure that basically we work safe, that our people are safe, and we have less LTIs and deaths. I don't think the processes in South African mining is anti-safety or is negate safety. So that's why we do fundamentally believe that if you don't have a mindset change around safety, which the University of Northwest says 80% of the problem of safety is that. But the funny thing is, when an incident happens, guess what happens? We give more paperwork. We say there's more processes that are needed. We talk to the people. We sometimes may be threatened. When actually we need to come down to underlying reasons, what actually happened there? What's your view? And work with the teams and the people to ensure that safety kind of like improves. I think, Konwane, if you've been there, that you stood and you've listened to your supervisor, and the safety chat is basically just a tick box exercise. It's like, I'm just going to talk about it. I'm like, remember, be safe, be your brothers, keep on water, water. And you're like, this guy's not really excited about that. And then he thinks I've done my bit. Meanwhile, there's no heartfelt in it. That's why we say on the safety side, we want to work with mindsets. How do you see things, change mindsets? And we've got a lot of profiling on that too. So safety compliance, safety issues around that. Yeah, that's that.
So just again, around safety, I mean, you will find that in most mines, they are moving towards the technological advancement.
Yeah.
Personally, I believe it's a double-edged sword. So you have machinery that will be implemented, which will impact the safety stats positively by moving people away from harm. But also at the same time, you will find that it can also negatively influence productivity when now you have reduced labor force, which in turn could mean there's social unrest. Yeah. We have high unemployment rates in South Africa. So that can also be a concern, that we're propagating the unemployment rates, to the negative side. So making it all worse. So I think in terms of striking that balance, I mean, there's been discussions around reskilling some of the people that would, for example, be retrenched. But how practical also is that? Because yes, we want technology to help us advance in terms of productivity and also safety. But at the same time, we start then impacting the human factors, where now you have people that are losing morale. Some have lost their jobs, friends. And as such, you find that you're between a rock and a hard place. But how do we ensure that we strike that correct balance, where we are winning in terms of creating a safe environment, especially for those mines that are so deep that the conditions underground do not make it favorable to have people working in those type of spaces. But at the same time, ensuring that we are empowering our frontline leaders, our miners, and at the same time, ensuring that the organization also is benefiting from productivity.
So if you say, and there's a lot of stuff that you've asked now. So on the reskilling side, we're very cautious on the reskilling side, and I'm not saying it's successful or failure. As a company, we're cautious on the aspects of reskilling. So we obviously all say we believe in reskilling, because that's like, otherwise these people will lose their jobs. But what we have also said is that if a person has worked for 20 or 30 or 40 years in a certain role, if he's 40 years, it's going to be retirement. So they might say he's a VOP for you and goodbye. But let's say you've been working 10, 15 years, 20 years maximum in a certain role. And now suddenly you get told, okay, now you're going to go underground and you're going to do, sit with some automated drilling and that. Now, the change that needs to happen is something that you've got to ask yourself, How effective are we going to be in that? Is this just window dressing, or do we really believe these individuals can be reskilled and be effective in their reskilling? Or is it kind of like, well, we feel we've got to, you know, we've got to do it because, you know, it's been our workforce and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm always nervous about the reskilling side. Is that I always say conceptually, yes, we should reskill. But I'm always also saying is that, well, you're not going to 100% reskill people, because then then in a sense your cost per ton will kind of like go up, because you put in new technology and you've kept the same amount of people, unless you've built it in such a way. So that's one thing. The other thing too is on the reskilling side, that's that over there. And you, let's say you're taking people from open pit to underground, or underground to open pit, it's a whole different, conventional to mechanized mining is already, it's not like, oh my goodness, it's just, oh, you know, I'll quickly just relearn something. So those are the things you've got to kind of like take into consideration. The issue around about, a lot of the old conventional mines, you cannot actually mechanize. It's the way the ore body sits, the way that they've built the mine. It's, you'll find most of it will not. So you're always going to have, you're going to have mines with masses of people, because it's conventional mining. And obviously the more people you have, the more chance of the deeper and the more people, and it's conventional, the more chances you're going to have of safety incidents. Although it seems to be, the saving environment is really at the moment is looking really good in that aspect over there. You will never find companies going, we will sacrifice safety for productivity. You'll never find companies doing that. You will find individuals that might say it underground. I've spoken to people that have witnessed illegal blasts and been part of illegal blasts. But fundamentally, that's not the message. Like, you know, do illegal blasts. That's not the message. But you do find people that have done it. But fundamentally, that's hopefully that has been weeded out somewhere along the line. A classic case for me was that the supervisor on one side. I must tell you the story. That was a real classic. I was even showing the photos. The supervisor on one site was with his girlfriend in where they lived, and he gave the go ahead for a blast from his bucky in the township he was in, and they didn't see that behind the ridge was an excavator, I think, there was no one in there; it was just standing there. And so they blasted, and they blasted this thing. Yeah. Well, it was covered with obviously with the it was an open pit mine, and then they took photos and they showed us, and then they started tracking where was the supervisor. They thought, oh no, he was over there. Like, oh my word. So that's a mindset issue perfectly, you know, like you shouldn't have blasted. You should have done nothing. But in essence, he said, you got to do that. So you are always going to get people that are going to try and push it. And we've seen from our stats, that there's personalities there that are risky personalities. But with a lot of diagnostics now, you're actually kind of like trying to weed out the risky personality that's unsafe. Those are the things. The other thing we also find is that, you know, one of the big things to attack safety is visible felt leadership. You know, you need to see them. And you need to do safety checks there. But what we're finding most of the time, they are spending their time checking PPE, when, to be brutally honest, PPE is kind of like not really your concern. You should be looking at from heights and isolations, all that kind of stuff there. But now they can say, oh, no, I've done my safety walk. I've done my, you know, checking out on the people and that. But we're saying, yeah, but you've got to check where is the safety concerns that are being highlighted. And you're going to start looking for them specifically, not, no, but I did my walk. I mean, I'm that guy. I care. We're like, yeah, well, you do care, but you got to be a little bit more. So that's what we try and say to people. Try and move away from compliant safety to actually looking at, okay, is this a safe environment? But ensuring Look, safe work, if the safer you work, you get production. Because obviously, as you said, every time there's a safety incident, there's a Section 54 and there's a whole... And at Goldfields, they closed operations globally due to this, to say, well, we're reviewing everything. So from that point of view there, a non-safe environment will actually affect productivity. And a safe environment actually will enhance productivity. If I don't feel I'm safe... Boy, I'm going to be seriously worried, and my motivation is going to be killed, and I'm going to be nervous about doing what I need to do. If I feel the company's got my back, my frontline leader's got my back, I'm walking into an environment where the chances are slim that anything bad happens to me, you will find is that people will work hard because they know that they are, that they walk into an environment that is 99.9% is a safe environment for them. And they don't have to worry about that. Every person needs to get home safely. I have no idea if that made any sense, Kondwani.
Yes.
I never answered your question.
No, you definitely did. I wanted to expand just around some of the factors that do impact productivity, especially within the mining industry specifically. And in the article that I did mention by David Humphreys, some of the factors that you mentioned, I think we discussed this in length. Innovation and technological change, we discussed that. There's some factors as well, like, you know, resource depletion and ore quality, which does impact productivity as well. Government regulations.
Yeah.
Worker quality, which we discussed in detail, which is around competences. Investment lags, economies of scale, capacity utilization, strikes, accidents, and unplanned production stoppages, which we also just discussed. But what I want to sort of deep dive a bit in is around government regulations. What would you say government can do better in terms of some of the regulations that are actually there that can support to increase productivity within the mining and minerals industry?
Sure. Obviously, we understand government regulation. I'm trying to work it. I haven't really looked at how does government regulation impact on let's say day-to-day productivity. The only things that this is from experience being on mines, you find that individuals within the certain different regions of mining, that when they hit a Section 54, they'll do a blanket Section 54 when in essence you could potentially have isolated it only to the one area. Or they basically will throw a Section 54 for maybe one or two fire extinguishers just being out of date in potential admin area. Now, I've been on mines where that's actually happened, where, you know, they did a check and they just suddenly threw a Section 54 because there was... You know, and I'm not discounting your extinguishers have to be up to date. Don't get me wrong. It's not saying, well, you know, we must. I knew the one time mine managers were being called in because there was an issue with how explosive was being transported. But actually, it was the contractor that was transporting the explosive, and suddenly the mine manager was made kind of like he had to be pulled in and had to explain why. And so all these things kind of eat at productivity because it causes more stoppages. I don't think the government legislation around specifically Section 54 that is wrong. I don't think that's a, but what we have noticed is issues around about the individuals who are implementing it. There doesn't seem to be a consistency of how it gets implemented and the punishments towards it, and that I think there's slight lag between different individuals. I mean, I had a senior GM once tell me, no, they rather interact with this person from the DMRE than that. But it's a little bit gamey. They kind of like game the system, and that this so that's the kind of thing over there. The other thing that's not government regulation, but in essence is due to government, is obviously community unrest. I mean, there's a lot of. I mean, I think on the East Limb, on the mines that we worked on the East Limb, boy, there was community disruption in essence on sometimes a weekly basis, and then no one could get to the mine. And this disruption is obviously around about there's a request that the mines take on, local workforce, which, and Kondwana, you've been in mines, but if you don't pass the fitness, if you can't pass the fitness to do the basic stuff, the mine cannot take you on, because that is a safety issue. You can't have unhealthy people working on a mine. I mean, that's dangerous. So, or people that cannot do the basic job, you can't do that. So, and all these mines have cadet systems. They're all getting people from the community in, but it's like the community then forces stoppages, blocks the mine entrance. And a lot of it is we want work, which is in South Africa, that is a fundamental question. I mean, we have high unemployment rate. So you can understand that aspect. But the problem there is that suddenly the mines are trying to, their hands are, I don't want to say their hands are tied, but in essence, they can't solve the unemployment problem. We were in a mine, we were in the Northern Cape a few years ago, and I mean, there was massive stoppages, and the mines were basically asked to build schools and roads and all that jazz. Now, and to be honest, the mines then sat with the municipality, and they worked out something, and they helped. But if you listen to the senior general manager, he's kind of like saying, I'm being confronted by communities to deliver on kind of provincial and municipality stuff, because the province and the municipality are not providing it, and that's for lots of reasons there. So to say that the mines cannot live outside of where South Africa is at. That's a given. You can't divorce yourself from your environment. You can't say, well, we're a global mine, so that's tough. We don't care a hoot about roads, schools, water, whatever is out there, transport. So you can't divorce it. But what you're hearing is, and it's not over, but what you're hearing is that the mines are saying, we can't solve every single problem that our surrounding communities have. It's just impossible. I mean, Richards Bay Minerals is a classic. I mean, they started to assassinate the mining to get kind of like Rio Tinto's attention on what's going on there. And Richard Bayman was like, well, this is a fight. It's actually a fight in the community that's now become our fight. And now we have to solve it. And then obviously that pressured, the government to come down and help solve it, because it's kind of like not a good reputation on the mining side to do that. So you do get a feeling that the mines are saying, we can't solve, we can help. And to be honest, they really want to help, because, if a happy community creates a happy work environment, and our whole premise from OIM is that if we make people more competent and capable, the benefits flow to the community. Because if people make the bonuses, if the company expands, then there's a community benefit. So the mines are always saying we want to help in that, but in essence, they're going, look, we can't solve the myriad of problems here. That's just it becomes an issue around that. So. Is that about government legislation? No, that's not about government legislation. I think government legislation, to be honest, is pretty good. But it's about, because the government is not effectively delivering in certain communities, you start finding is that the community in essence says, but you guys are the ones that are providing most of the money in this area, or you're here in this area, and so we need help. And that creates the tension between the two communities. And a lot of communities, to be honest, I mean, a lot of people working on the mines come from the communities. So that's a given that will be felt there. So yeah, those are, I would say, constraints in the whole story.
Fantastic. And I do believe that, with all challenges, there's always going to be opportunities.
Yeah.
Maybe in closing, again, drawing from your experience, especially in operational excellence, what are some of the biggest killers in terms of operational excellence initiatives, but also what are some of the amplifiers that do make those initiatives work, and how can we then gear ourselves, as a country, as people playing within this industry, to ensure that we do support such initiatives and ensure that, we are adding that value, because we do want to see a sustainable mining and minerals industry, for the next 30, 100 years, and so on.
So basically, the number one operational excellence killer is no leadership support, top leadership support. That, I mean, if you kick off a program or a project and you have no leadership support, so in essence, I'm talking about your, if I'm being mind specific, that would be your senior leadership team. So if your GM, senior GM, HODs, if none of them support the basically what needs to happen, then you're on a hiding to nothing. And that usually happens when head office says, mine XU now will use these people to do this work. And the GMs are like, okay, well, the boss has told me, so okay, sure. And then voila, they never come to steer comms, and they basically they're not visible and all that. And then that's the number one thing. I find projects never fail technically. They fail tactically. I find projects, you find it is when you deploy people on a project, and Kwana, you yourself have been on projects and still are, is you usually find the right mix of people, you usually find the right skills to solve the problem that's been put in front of you. So technically, we never struggle. I mean, technically, you're going like, yes, here's the best people for the job and it's going to happen. I find tactically is where projects fail, is when the people that really need to buy into the project, that really need to own the projects, are the ones that say, you know, we'll just wait them out. They'll be gone in 6 months' time. So awesome. That's wonderful. And they nod their head. They're either against you, as in, we don't like you, or they're like, just nod their head and say, oh, yeah, no, good. Oh, yeah, that's fine. And then when the end comes, you're like, gee, but these people don't believe in anything here. And that's, we call that a project failure, that the tactical side hasn't really worked. And the tactical side is getting the people to own the project. So that's the one thing there. On a more down-to-earth level, what we found is what makes people buy into the program and make it successful is so let's say top leaders is bought in, but I'm talking about the people right at the bottom, the guys that we work with, you know, you walk a path with them, is firstly when they meet you, they're very skeptical, like, oh my word, what do these people know? But it's to take them from a mechanical doing stuff to where they see ownership. So to basically sit with them and say, we're going to now work this thing out. And then we say, look, just mechanically do what we tell you. Just trust us. You know, and when a consultant says trust us, people get worried. But anyway, trust us. We've done this before. This will work. And then mechanically they start filling stuff in. And then they're like, oh, now I understand why I'm doing this. Yes. Okay. Now they get conceptually. They're going, okay. Hang on. No. So, why are we doing this is actually X, Y, Z, and that impacts. Okay, now conceptually they're going, okay, now I get that. And then ownership. And you only get ownership is once they start seeing the dial moves, they go, flip, I'm getting better blast. I mean, flip, the availabilities are improving. The KPIs start moving. Then they start getting ownership because then they see, oh, wow, this is actually working. And this is flipping fundamentally working. That's great. And then you start moving the dial there, but we're not trying to make people 100% competent in their role. What we want to do is we want to make them competent enough to turn the dial, just turn the dial. But we notice when people turn the dial, they're like, "Ooh, hang on." And then you remind them, "Hey, turning the dial is bigger bonus," and they're like, "Geez, you know." And then suddenly everyone wants to pull together because they like this bigger bonus idea. And then a bigger bonus is also a benefit for family and friends. And so everyone then starts moving the dial. So that's why we take people from mechanical to conceptual to ownership. That's how you, ownership only comes out when people see just this benefit. It's moving, my KPI is moving, but also understand they link that KPI to an absolute understanding of what that means for them. Yeah. So if I have more effective blasts, that brings more tons. That means, and my bonus is linked to something. Then you find there's better ownership. And I'm not saying people are just money motivated. That's not the thing here. But there's motivation to see, okay, if we do well, this is what brings to us. I don't know if that answers your question.
It definitely answers my question. So in essence, we need to see tangible outcomes at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And that will keep people motivated and
yes,
increase productivity.
So obviously we're talking now to a lot of metallurgists here, is in essence saying, don't ensure that your stuff is theoretical. Ensure that whatever you're doing becomes practical and that it relates to the individual who you are talking to. That's it in a nutshell. Thank you very much. It's been wonderful talking to you.
It's been awesome. So yes, I think that brings us to the end of our podcast. It was a pleasure having you here, Arjun.
Thank you, good one.
Looking forward to more future discussions around
absolutely
productivity.
Yeah, no, it was good. Great chatting to you. Yeah, like
fantastic. Until next time.
Yes.
Thank you for listening. Please note that the facts and opinions expressed are those of the individual and do not reflect the position of SIAEM or the corporate institution.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.